We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovic. Joining me today is Bob Coleman from Idaho Armored Vaults and Steve St. Angelo of SRS Rocco Report. How are you guys today?
Good, Tom. How you doing?
Excellent.
Good, Tom. Doing great.
It's great to have you guys here. And, you know, we want to cover a fairly big topic today. You know, we're going to be talking about, let's say, the differences that we're seeing in the industry right now between actual coin and physical demand versus, you know, when the price is actually spiking and what's actually been happening right now. Bob, you and I had a bit of a back and forth here with Peter Spina the other day. And I think that really just captured it perfectly. Peter said, we should start hearing of bullion dealers running low on physical silver supplies, having inventory problems, likely between $26 to $30 an ounce. Unobtainium will be represented in huge spot plus markup fees for physical. That is when it gets dangerous to buy and overpay on premiums. So that is the statement that was put forth. And, you know, taking that at face value, I absolutely agree with that. You know, when we have price spikes like this, it makes you think, man, the demand just must be going crazy. The market is seeing something and anticipating something that, you know, maybe isn't being picked up on at this point. And Bob, you replied and you said quite the contrary. The industry is in trouble as prices rise. So where is this disconnect coming from right now? And what are you seeing from the retail demand side?
Well, I appreciate Peter's work. So it wasn't anything disparaging to his remark.
He does a great job.
Yeah, he does a great job.
The reason I bring that up, and again, same from myself to Peter, if he does see this, it's not that we're trying to be disparaging. It's just, I think, an excellent illustration of this sentiment within the industry if we don't necessarily know exactly what's going on from the actual retail level, like you are very experienced.
Yeah, I tend to see, not only from the retail level, but watching the markets, reading all the tea leaves, I guess, out there. You try to uncover all the stones and you talk to the industry and the professionals out there. You see the flow that's going on. Running a depository the size that we do, we get to see the activity and, you know, what's happening with IRA accounts and, you know, and that flow as well, you know, because what you're trying to gauge, there's a broader picture that you're trying to kind of capture here, which is, you know, sort of the overall sentiment, but that overall sentiment is not something that's like pulling up a chart on, you know, SLV, for example, and saying, oh, volume chart says there's not much volume on the rally, so therefore the rally may peter out. No pun intended. But the idea behind it is you're trying. There's a very broad picture here, and I think the last 4 years, not to get too critical of the industry, but and I've been very outspoken with how bad these premiums were getting the last 4 years to the upside, and the massive amount of overcharging that was happening in the industry at a time when the industry had an absolute opportunity to capture the broader Main Street public sort of perception of metals, what metals are for, you know, store value, what they can protect from, and how they can be used as an asset of someone's portfolio. Well, the industry basically just took that and just threw it to the wolves, and they just marked up, they profiteered. They basically took total advantage of their client base. And I know because I saw the types of markups that were happening compared to what I was charging in the industry, which was night and day. And now what you have is over the last 6 or 8 months, this idea where people are just worn out. You know, they held the stuff for 15, 20 years. They may have bought it in the last 3 or 4 years because maybe they looked at the metals as some sort of market or money market equivalent because we were at zero interest rates. So they figured, well, why not just buy precious metals? Because this promoter or this guy on YouTube says silver's going to go to $200 an ounce in the next 6 months or the next 2 years, I'm going to make out like a fat rabbit and all my dreams are going to come true. Well, that never happened. And they end up vastly overpaying for the metals. They see the stock market going up to new all-time highs. You see the crypto market on fire. You know, the real estate market hasn't gone down like everyone said it was going to. You know, the debt markets haven't imploded yet. And commercial real estate still, it's struggling, but it hasn't imploded yet either. So a lot of the naysayers basically got discredited, and people were like, now I'm stuck in this asset. I overpaid for it. Now I want to get out of it. And so what's happened in the industry, going from a one-way street of only seeing buying activity, now it's a very two-way market where dealers have been inundated with product coming back to them. And most of these business models that you've seen on these big online retail dealers online, for example, a lot of those people aren't designed to basically buy back and hold that metal like they're a hedge fund or mm-hmm. you know they're a believer till the end of time that the metals are going to go up. They run a business, and so the idea is their model was that okay, it's based on volume. I'm always going to be having buyers buy the metal. I just got to sit on this thing for maybe a couple weeks, but I'll end up selling it right back out the door to somebody else. Well, now what's happening is they're starting to see a pile up of inventory. You know, if they're using a line of credit, they're seeing their line of credit, you know, get to extensions or peaks where they're, you know, you're seeing a degree of uncomfortableness. That uncomfortableness is being shown very directly in the market by the bids that they're providing to their customers when those customers want to sell metal back to them. The bids have collapsed. So now you got people that paid $5 over spot or $6 over spot for a 100-ounce silver bar. Now they're going to sell this bar, and I'm seeing bids, you know, as low as $1.50 under spot for that same bar. It's a massive swing and spread risk that was not sort of transparent to the person who bought it, mm-hmm. you know, understanding that, hey, this is a potential risk you could be looking at. So be careful how much you pay in terms of premium, which is what I was yelling from the rooftops on. Now you're seeing a complete, you know, implosion of bids, and you're seeing it not just on the retail side, but also on the wholesale side. So, and now you're seeing product that was maybe, you know, 2-3 years ago when it was tough to get product and product was tight, and you were seeing these pop-ups of private mentors, you were seeing overseas mentors that at refiners that really weren't into the retail game. They were more on the industrial side. They jumped into the retail product game. Well, you know, those products which weren't really well supported now aren't even seeing bids, or if they are seeing bids, they're greatly discounted. And in some instances, if they're coming from a country that could be in a conflict because of what's going on in the Middle East, compliance is saying, listen, don't buy those bars. The only way you can buy them, for example, is if you melt them into another product. So, which is not something I think the industry really was prepared for. And so what I try to do on Twitter or X is try to not necessarily be the boy who cried wolf and trying to talk down the competitors. I'm trying to reach to the public and say, listen, there is risks in this industry. No matter whether you store your metals with your dealer or you buy your metals with a dealer, there's counterparty risk, there's storage risk, there's the structure programs, the way these structure programs are set up. You know, you're seeing them, you know, certain companies broaden out into commercial real estate and other types of business activities that may be contrary to why you bought the metals in the first place. And you're trying to look for someone that's going to be sound and prudent with their own balance sheet, yet they're taking risks. So why would you want to keep storing your metal in that type of situation? The landscape is shifting greatly. And so when you start to understand this, and you see what's happening, basically, as these balance sheets are being filled up with inventory, and whether someone has a line of credit or they're just using their bank balance sheet or their cash basically to hold on to the inventory, you have carrying costs that start to come into the cost of that business. And those carrying costs are First, if you're a line of credit, you're paying an interest rate. Second, you're paying to store that metal at a facility. And third, you're paying to hedge that product in the event that you may have, you're trying to create a price neutral environment for your inventory, especially if you're borrowing money from a bank. The bank's going to say, listen, you have to hedge that because we don't want to take the risk that if the market implodes, you're not going to be able to pay back your loan. So now you have this situation that's unfolded, and I've been documenting this for the last couple months. And I wrote an article about it, about lease rates and so forth, and how what could actually happen to, and it's happened to the mining industry, especially in the mid-2000s, when you saw that miners really hedged out, and all of a sudden the price of the metals go up, their hedge book blows up on them, and then they end up taking these massive losses, which they could, they had the advantage of going into the capital markets and borrowing money or issuing more debt, which is diluting equity shareholders. These dealers don't have that opportunity because they're not publicly traded companies. So you have a real situation here where their hedges, whether they're short the futures market or some other type of structured arrangement with a refiner or a bank, as the price goes up, they're sitting on inventory that they have to hedge. All of a sudden, their hedges start to go underwater. And they start getting margin calls. They have to come up with money to pony up to cover when you're short the market and it goes against you, you have to pony up more money to keep that hedge in place. Well, that's what's been happening. And the danger is that the prices continue to rise, and these dealers, as the public says, listen, I don't trust the rally because everyone says, the market's going to get slammed or it's going to come crashing back down because that's what the cartel does, so to speak, is they're never going to allow this thing, to poke its head above water. I'm just going to dump silver at 26 because it's just going to go right back down to 22. So you have that mentality that's broadening across the Western markets. And so people are selling into these rallies, not trusting them. And these dealers are sitting there taking in more and more inventory, and they're not selling it because people don't want to chase because they chased in the last 3 years and they've just gotten, it's like, whack-a-mole, they've gone nowhere. They've just overpaid for the metal. The price goes back down and then they feel like they're the schmuck. So now you have this quandary that's happening to the market that as the prices go up, you could actually see the industry blow up like the mining industry did back in the mid-2000s without the balance sheet to back up, these dealers. And that's where I'm trying to relay this risk, especially if you're storing metal with companies that their parent company is a dealer, so to speak, or a transaction-based company, and they rely on these transaction models to pay their bills. Also, on the depository side, just be very careful. You need to ask questions. You need to really and ask hard questions. Get documents. Get if they have a balance sheet. Try to get as much disclosure out of them as possible. But that's what I'm seeing in the industry. And I kind of talked about this at the end of last year as well. I think we even did a Spaces back in November 2022, I believe, when you saw. A very big retail dealer put a full page ad in the Wall Street Journal talking about how they were going to buy back Silver Eagles at $10 over spot, while at the same time they were charging $20 over spot for that same Silver Eagle. But these days of high premiums, I think are I think unless we have an event, I think there's just too much overhead supply now. When you really look at the last 20 years of this industry, of how much metal that can come into the market, especially with rates higher where they're at today.
So, Bob, maybe we should make that a little bit more explicit. When people go out and they buy silver, let's say, silver ounce or a bar, what is the premium that they tend to have paid, let's say, over the last 6 months?
Well, the premiums have definitely come down. This time last year, that 1 ounce round could have been $5, $5.50 over spot. Okay. I've seen some crazy numbers, and now, I haven't looked at it on my website. But it's like a dollar or something over spot. They've come down rather drastically, and then you've seen dealers now when they're sitting on inventory, they have these specials. So they'll try to unload product, you know, as these quote unquote specials of the day, so to speak. But what you have also happening is a lot of private minters who jumped into this fray over the last couple of years because of the high premiums, and they built out a facility, they, you know, purchased all the equipment, they started minting product. Well, they're getting maybe 40 cents an ounce, if they're lucky, on new product that's being made for the wholesale industry. There's no money to be made there. You know, these minters can't make money at 40 cents an ounce when it comes in time to ship the product to the wholesaler, you know, and fabrication and all that. So what you're having is these private minters are seeing a lot of pressure on their balance sheet. The question is, you know, how strong are they? How much can they withstand or hold out as the industry goes through this sort of two-way market where you're starting to have secondary supply kind of be all over the place? I mean, and on top of that, you have the main sovereign mints. You know, you saw, you know, the Royal Canadian Mint did a price drop on their 2024 products. Well, you know, the wholesale industry had loaded up on 2023 product, and they still have 2023 product. And now the 2024 product's cheaper than the 2023 product. And of course, as you go to a backdate year, you know, typically dealers will have to discount that 20, you know, that backdated year a little bit just to get rid of it. They don't want to be sitting on the inventory. So you get this sort of, I don't call it mini chaos that's happening within the industry itself.
So there's starting to be, you know, again, just to explain this a little bit simpler. There's seems to be a glut of supply of metal at this point. And then when you, let's say price gets up to $25, and that's where, you know, the average person says, I bought this, I'm sick of holding it, I want to go sell it. Now you're getting, you know, below what spot is to have to sell it back. And so, you know, what Bob is describing is a condition where we can't, you know, the retail isn't really going to be driving the price at this point because of this glut of metal at this point, and right, really lack of demand as well, it seems.
And on top of that, the retail public, it's like, you know, the fool me once, fool me twice type of a mentality is, they're not going to chase the market. You know, they're not, unless there's a massive event out there. They've learned or been conditioned that, okay, you get this event, whether it's the banking crisis last year or the Russian invasion in Ukraine, that these events are fleeting, and then they die out. And so I'll just wait, and I'll let the market come back to me. Well, now you have a situation where the metals, and I've been reading this very well the last probably 3 months, that sentiment is so bad out there that it's, from a contrarian standpoint, it's good. And not to be demeaning to the retail crowd. I mean, they're frustrated. I mean, you saw, you know, 2 weeks ago, you literally could have cut the sentiment, negative sentiment on mining stocks with, you know, a butter knife. I mean, not a butter knife, but a chainsaw. I mean, it was so thick. That's what you're seeing now that's driving the market is, it's, you know, the big hedge funds or the big guys that are, you know, the CTAs that have been, you know, have $1 billion notional short position in the futures market, you know, a couple weeks ago, and they're reading the sentiment, they're seeing the sort of chaos in the retail markets, and they're like, Fed's gonna, you know, maybe not rate or lower rates anytime soon because inflation's gonna, you know, maybe be more sticky than what we thought. And so they're playing the playbook of, okay, we're just gonna short because the dollar's gonna be strong, we're gonna short everything that's dollar related, and we're gonna make money. And so what's happened is the paper markets have gone, have actually created the fuel for this fire, of which the retail isn't even trusting the market anymore. So as the market goes higher, no one's chasing it, and then they're just selling into it on top of that. So and as this paper market drives even further to the upside, you're going to see even more selling by the retail, which is going to take in, you know, the balance, it's going to suck, you know, I guess overwhelm the balance sheets even more of the dealers and the wholesalers. And it's getting to a point where now wholesalers, you know, they've been, the last month, they've been pricing metal, you know, below spot because they have to, they may have to just send it to the refiner to melt back, you know, whether it's rounds, bars, coins, whatever it may be, because, you know, they can only hold so much. And this is the part where knowing your counterparty is so critical. You have to realize, you know, someone's business model, even though they may sound great on YouTube and they got a great promoter and they're well liked and they're everybody's friend, you know, money and business, it doesn't lie. I mean, if they're not well financed or they didn't prepare for this type of scenario, you know, they could get in trouble really quick.
Hey, Tom, Bob, can I step in for a second?
Absolutely.
Bob, we talked about this. Do you think part of the price move in silver that's happening now, this spike up, could it be due to what's happening actually in the wholesale dealer market?
Yeah, as they take in more inventory, they're shorting more paper to hedge that inventory that they're taking in, if that makes sense. So they're long physical. Let's say they bring in $2 million of physical. You know, people sell back $2 million. They go into the futures market. They sell $2 million worth of silver or gold, whatever they just bought. And so they're hedged. They're price neutral. Well, as that price rises, their hedge goes down in value because their underlying physical goes up in value. But their underlying physical, you know, what they have to remember is when you say I bought silver at $22 an ounce and I paid, you know, a dollar over spot for, you know, a round, for example, just use it for example. Now that the price of silver is at 24, well, when I bought that at 22, I sold a futures contract at 22. So I was price neutral. The price could go up or down. I wouldn't lose any money. What's happening now is the premiums are collapsing. So now instead of a dollar that you could sell that round for, now you may get 40 cents for it. So now, you've lost money, even though the price of silver has gone up and your inventory value has gone up. The premium, which is really the differential, is that's going down, is creating a permanent loss for you unless you let go of the hedge and you start to play the market and take chances. And that's what's sort of that's what's creating some of this of friction, you could say, because at some point you can only take in so much inventory, so you're going to ultimately at some point let go of those hedges and sell the inventory to a wholesaler or a refiner who's going to pay even less for that metal. And so with the industry, you know, some of the well-capitalized ones that have been in business for, you know, for multitude of different cycles, they kind of realize when the times are great, you know, you put the money away into a purse, but when times go bad, you may have to take those losses from time to time and mark down that inventory. I that's the part that the industry saw so many players come into this business the last 4 years. I don't think they have the balance sheet to withstand, you know, another 6 months of this activity. As the prices go up, they're not, you know, they're having to buy at even higher prices.
Buying back at even higher prices.
Yeah, sorry.
So could you explain how this could push this kind of event as it continues to happen? How could that push the, you know, like a short squeeze? Someone's on the wrong side. But who's on the wrong side? Is it and some people say it, like the, it's funny, you see these different on social media. Is the cart the silver price going up? The cartel is losing, and really, what's happening? It's the industry that's being cannibalized. It's not really a good sign. It's not the cartel is losing. It's the industry that's being negatively impacted. And then you bring up an excellent point that the market doesn't know this. So how would the cannibalization, the weakening as more selling happens, how would that drive the price even higher?
Because what happens is as these wholesalers and retailers take in more metal, they sell more futures contracts, they hedge their underlying physical exposure. They can't sell the physical. It's just sitting on the shelf, you know, burning a hole in their pockets. They're watching the price potentially not go down, but the price is staying stubbornly high. They can't, you know, they're not selling this metal. They're watching the premiums very, very closely and the premiums aren't helping them either, they may be forced to unwind the inventory because, like we've seen in the last 2 weeks, you've had this breakout in the gold market, and nobody's, you know, you're not seeing a lot of gold activity. You're not seeing, you know, this massive amount of retail activity like you saw in 2022, 2023. And so as the price rises and they're holding these futures positions and the futures positions are going against them, they're either having to pony up more money from their bank balance sheet, which is probably non-existent at this point because they're up to their gills in inventory. They're going to be forced to sell the inventory at a potential loss, close out the futures position, which means buying back the futures position, which is actually supportive for the market, which in turn is going to potentially take the market even higher. And you take that, you know, through an entire industry that really has been selling a boatload of metal the last 4 years. And now that's a lot of potential fuel that could be coming back that's unwinding this whole carry trade. And then on top of that, and this is why this gets into a different realm of the exchange for physical premium, which is very confusing. You see a lot of these guys on YouTube, which absolutely have no clue what they're talking about. And it's very frustrating to watch because they try to use big words and they try to, it's almost like verbal diarrhea almost. You know, they use these terms to basically say, this is what's going to happen. And the exchange for physical is going to be the tool that basically, you know, drains the COMEX. It has nothing to do with that. It's just a spread trade between the London market and the COMEX futures market. And there's a typical premium that's associated with that because as you're currently right now, for example, take silver, for example, that's in a contango, meaning that the May silver contract price is higher than today's actual spot price. And the why that's the case is that, you know, interest rates are 5%. And so you have this carrying cost built into this time between now and May that requires, you know, a sort of a holding cost that gets factored into that higher futures price. And then you have you know, also the carrying costs of saying, listen, I can also hold the metal in a facility so that I'd be compensated for holding that metal as well till the May contract. But what happens is these EFPs naturally will go to zero, you know, between now and the lead month expiration. So in this instance would be May. So when you had in February, you had the roll of silver contract from February to May. Typically what happens is, you know, you have, you know, the spread goes to zero, and then all of a sudden one day when you have the contract roll, it goes, but pops up to 25 cents, you know, spread between the London market and the higher New York new contract price. And so you see, you know, maybe half a cent or a penny decline a day, you know, it's, you know, amortized over, you know, the course of 45 days, however that holding time is. So it ultimately goes to zero. So let's just say, for example, it drops a penny a day or half a penny a day, just basically on time decay. Well, typically that EFP premium would drop from 25 cents to 24 and a half cents to 24 cents to 23 and a half cents, you know, day after day, it would just grind down. And what happens is, the banks typically take that side of the trade where they're basically on one side making the market with the idea that the EFP premium always ends up going to zero. But the problem you start to have though is you have to have a pretty big balance sheet when you're the counterparty to an EFP trade because you're dealing with a lot of money. But what happened in March of 2020, which was when the gold market blew out after the market took a nosedive, and then all of a sudden you had the London market seize up because COVID and they shut everything down and you couldn't get physical metal from the mine. And so all of a sudden everyone had to say, listen, I'm long the physical and I'm short the futures, but I don't have the long physical anymore because I can't even get to it because the whole economy just shut down. I got to close out my futures contract. And so you buy back the futures contract at whatever price you can close your position out at. And so in March of 2020, you had the price go from, you know, say zero to $76 over spot over the London market. And you saw massive losses in the banking industry. Well, the same thing is kind of happening here in the silver market because the last 7 or 8 days, Actually, I should say since the end of February, the EFP premium in silver hasn't dropped. It's staying stuck at between 21 and 22 cents over the London market, which is really strange. It means someone is potentially caught short here. We're on the wrong side of a trade, and you know, they're trying to get out. And that's why you're seeing the futures market lift in price. And instead of seeing decay in that EFP, the futures market rising in price is making up for that decay that would normally happen. And that's a sign that I try to watch for as, you know, a guy who runs a hedge fund and watches and manages money. You try to look for all these little nuances that are happening within the market that most people don't try to, you know, they just don't catch.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Bob, one thing, you said that someone's on the wrong side of the trade, which is why that premium is not coming down. Is that a wrong side of the trade issue, or is that a physical issue similar to what it was back in March 2020?
That's a great question. It's not as much of a physical issue as it is on the paper side, because that EFP, it works in two directions. You know, it can go into what they call backwardation, which we kind of saw back in 2022 when interest rates were at 0%. And then all of a sudden, you know, you had where the physical market was actually more expensive than the futures market. But, you know, with an interest rate of 5%, you won't see it. If we saw a backwardation with an interest rate this high, you would be seeing extreme tightness in the physical market. We're not seeing that. You're seeing a contango. It's just that the paper markets are set up that they can also get stretched, or they can also get pressed. And that's what's actually happening is you're seeing the CTAs, for example, when they went $1 billion net short physical or short silver on paper, and all of a sudden the silver market stops going down. Well, that's a lot of contracts that have to be bought back up. That creates a short squeeze that then drives the price back up. That then also you have the industry. And then you have the industry who short the market because they got so much physical inventory. It's saying, my God, now we're going underwater because we're having to pony up more money for our futures contracts or our hedges. But and then it gets into something really interesting on SLV, because SLV is something that I've been watching, and it's been very strange. The activity that we're seeing, this massive amount of selling or short sales that have been going off the last 8 days or so in SLV has been, you see about 800,000 shares or maybe 1.5 million, something of that range. But you've been seeing, you know, 4+ million shares. In fact, yesterday, I think it was over 5 million shares short. And you haven't seen, even with this big rally the last few days in silver, you haven't seen an ounce or new shares being created. It's almost as if the market makers are, or somebody is shorting shares to meet any public demand that's coming into the market. And so someone was mentioning, well, maybe it's just the institutions just getting out of the market completely. But then you had a great chart, Steve, where you looked at GLD and you're like, the institutions haven't changed their positions at all.
No. Yeah. And that's the interesting thing. Even if you look at the institutional market, Tom, the SLV institutional shares has declined since mid-2022, and that's when the Fed started raising interest rates. But it only declined about 20 million shares. It's the rest of the market has sold almost 80 million more shares. So institutions have declined in their SLV about 20 million shares since, let's say, third quarter of 2022. But the GLD, it's flat. They haven't sold any shares. So Luke Groman put out a chart showing what's going on with the GLD, because is it maybe a bank run on gold? Someone, they're liquidating the gold out of the GLD and someone's buying it. The institutions haven't sold it. So it seems to me, and this is my analysis, is that it's hedge funds, it's high net worth individuals, it's retail. They're selling and they're getting into treasuries.
What gives you the impression that they're selling gold to get into treasuries?
Well, now this is what I'm thinking, because when you look at the GLD flows and the gold price since 2008, they have corresponded to each other. Now, I'm not saying that the flows in and out of the GLD dictate the gold price. Mm-hmm. But that has been a relationship. Since mid-2022, it changed. And you can look at the charts. Luke Rowan put a chart out. And we see that the GLD continues to decline, but gold is hitting a new high. The problem is people say, well, that's a lot of Chinese buying and that central bank buying. Well, central banks are buying more gold. But they're not buying enough gold to offset declines coming from net outflows of the GLD and elsewhere. And furthermore, according to the World Gold Council, the central banks bought 39 metric tons of gold in January. Now you go back the last quarter, they bought 230. You divide by three, it's like 75 tons a month. This January, they're half. They're about half of what they were buying every month last year. So even the central banks have kind of eased up. We don't know February. We don't know March yet. That'll come out in a couple of months. Mm-hmm. So just, and I talk to people in the industry, people who are, you know, people who have gold, when interest rates are zero, you protect your wealth. But if the Federal Reserve or the Euro's Treasury is going to pay you 5.5% interest, Now, this is my speculation. I'm not saying it's correct, but we've always seen the price of the gold and the GLD inventories move up and down together. It's kind of, and so it only changed when they started raising rates rapidly starting in mid-2022. So when you notice that the institutions really haven't sold much of their gold or GLD or the SLV, they've sold some, but most of it, I think, is outside the institutional market. So that's what I'm seeing.
So guys, I think this is a perfect spot to ask both of your opinions on this. If, you know, there's no demand from the retail side and we're seeing, you know, higher demand for treasuries at these 5.25%, 5.5% rates, what is driving the price of gold at this point? You know, we're over $2,100. We're very close to an all-time high. Silver is trying to poke its head above water. What is driving the price at this point?
Well, it's oddly, it's the paper markets that are caught on the wrong side of the market. Mm-hmm. I was going to maybe jump in on what Steve was talking about when it comes sure. to the players that are getting maybe why you're seeing the ETF flows diverging from the price of the actual underlying asset. I mean, because Steve's absolutely right on. I mean, in the past, it was like, you know, these things moved in lockstep with each other. You know, price goes up, inventory flow goes up, and share count goes up, and that type of thing. I think what's happening is with the advent of the ETFs of Bitcoin and so forth, I think you also saw over the last mm-hmm. couple of years, as the stock market, you know, bottoming, was it in 2020, late 2022, I think you had this sort of de-risking and deleveraging and authorized participants who are also their broker dealers. You know, they also are bullion banks. You know, they may have leased metal from central banks in order to meet the demand, you know, maybe the last 5-6 years of GLD's increase in share count, and now what you're seeing is as rates are higher, the carrying costs and the need to actually have these structured products that the broker dealers create, and I can get into that a little bit. You're seeing attention going elsewhere, and broker dealers will create product and they'll go where the money's flowing. You know, they're not going to keep their metal at or keep their inventory and capital tied up in gold in the GLD ETF if no one's really buying it. They're going to start pulling that inventory out of GLD. And you're going to remember the authorized participants, which are the broker dealers, are the ones who have the control of creating and redeeming shares, and which means they can contribute or take the metal back. Of the underlying of whatever ETF they're actually being an authorized participant for. So you have potentially this big decline you've been seeing has basically been this sort of shift of capital flows into other asset classes. And basically, yes. These broker dealers have just said, listen, we're not going to hold the inventory. We're going to, if we're releasing that gold from the central bank, we're just going to give it back to the central bank, close out the lease, and you know, on we go to the next asset class that we can pump up. And lo and behold, like the ETFs, you know, these things have been, you've had sort of these, I kind of call it, I put a tweet out today, kind of call it the cup and scandal chart. But the,
are you talking about Bitcoin?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, because you've had this very odd relationship where you've had, you know, the big players like BlackRock and some of these big players talking about the last 6 months, oh, Bitcoin is the greatest thing in the world, whereas prior 6 months or a year before that, they were saying this thing's a complete fad, or, you know, it you know, there's a lot of skepticism to it. And then you have the SEC saying, we'll never approve a Bitcoin ETF. But you had this, like, almost like someone knew something was happening, because you had this, you know, the Bitcoin was going up in value while you're having all this sort of shenanigans going on behind the scenes. And then lo and behold, you had this, you know, the ETF gets declared, or the number of them get declared to be legal. And then all of a sudden you had this, you know, whoever was buying all this the Bitcoin was then selling it to the ETFs, and then now the ETFs are selling it to the retail, and you got this massive distribution that's going on. It's like classic distribution, and at a time where it just goes to show you that, you know, Wall Street will move wherever that money is going to, wherever it's going to become hot. That's where they're going to apply their capital base. And as interest rates rise, you have to remember the Fed, you know, doing their QT and so forth. Broker dealers, you know, don't have as much capital as they had during a QE type of environment. So you have this, you know, you almost rely on the mania of the markets and the margin that's created and the higher prices that are created from collateral to keep the market perpetuating higher. And that's what's happening here. And so as the GLD and SLV have seen a contraction in inventory and shares outstanding and so forth, it has absolutely no bearing to the actual price itself, because it's, to them, it's just moving capital from one asset class to another. And a lot of people, hedge fund guys, and I've been watching this stuff on the Office of Comptroller Currency Reports, you know, as part of the article I put out the other day, that shows that, you know, in 2023, you've had about a $50 billion notional value decline in derivatives in the precious metals category. And you have to remember, these derivatives are, a lot of it is just structured products that Wall Street creates. So think of it as the movie The Big Short, where Michael Burry goes to one of the big Wall Street houses and says, listen, I want you to structure me a product because I want to short the housing market. And they start laughing at him. Well, that's what this stuff is. It's structured products created by the broker dealer that sells to an institution that's wanting that type of product. And if they want exposure to silver, they're not really actually wanting the physical. They're just wanting exposure to the price. And so what Wall Street does is they create a structured product, base it off of the SLV. And in the article, I show like four different offerings, but there's tons of them out there. Well, what happens is they have an offering that's based on the price movement of SLV. So they may have to go in and contribute metal to SLV, take control of those shares, and then using this pool of shares, they can then write a structured product based off of that, and then they can use options and lever those shares to then sell more product out to these institutions. And you have to remember, this product that they're selling, it's the balance sheet of the bank or the balance sheet of that investment firm that's backing that investment, not necessarily SLV or even the metal that they initially put into SLV that's actually giving them the shares. It's a very convoluted type of structure that's maybe hard for a lot of people to wrap around their mind here. But what's happening is it's basically, think of it as these structured products as just massive sponges that suck in capital that says, listen, we want exposure to the silver price. And so someone says, listen, we're going to give you a product that says, you have 20% downside protection, you know, in case the market goes down, because remember, the precious metals are a very volatile asset class. So we're going to give you the first 20% drop in the market. It's going to be on us. And then on the other side, if the market goes up, we'll let you participate in 80% of the up move. And so institutions are like, you know, it's like a moth to the flame. They're like, this is the greatest thing in the world. Where do I put my money? That's what a lot of these products do. Whether they're buffered notes or whatever it may be, that's kind of what the article I wrote. And so as you've seen this sort of, you know, shift in asset prices and the stock market go to new all-time highs, and you're just seeing, you know, flow of capital from these broker dealers just being basically directed into other asset categories, whether it's AI or semiconductors or, you know, whatever's hot at the time, whatever they can sell the institution or whatever the institution wants to buy, that's what they're going to create and sell.
Bob wrote a good point. And if you look at the numbers, Tom, mm-hmm. If we go back to about mid-2022, the GLD has lost maybe about 5 million ounces of gold. That's how much gold has been taken out of the GLD, whatever it's been leased or held. So if you multiply that by $2,000, mm-hmm. that's $10 billion. Mm-hmm. The Bitcoin ETFs have raised $30 billion in a very short period of time. So that just goes to show you, Bob is correct, people are moving out of one asset, going into another. But I mean, $10 billion in the drop in the GLD, which is the largest gold ETF. And then we see these Bitcoin ETFs, they've brought in $30 billion in just a very short period of time. So when you look at the numbers, it is a very interesting change of asset values.
And that change took place in the ETFs actually in the beginning of 2023. Which is where you saw the end of 2022, really. But that's where the moment where the price and the share count started to diverge from each other. And that reconciles to the OCC derivatives report, where you started to see a decline in overall derivatives being reported by these banks to the Office of Comptroller Currency.
So, Steve, do you have a figure for how much metal left the SLV as well?
Well, you know, I do. Just give me, let me take a look. I think I had that. According to Fintel, which I use, since the mid-2022, the institutions have only sold off about 20 million shares. That's right, 20 million shares. And looking at the volume of silver in the SLV, it's down from mid-2022. It's down about 120, 130 million ounces, okay, in that same period of time. So it's down much more. Then I believe I'm going by the top in 22, but by mid it's about 70 million ounces compared to about 4 or 5 million ounces for the GLD. Mm-hmm.
So guys, what do you think accounts for that change in the ETFs? Why is metal leaving the ETFs?
Well, it's you have hot money in other asset classes. It's just, you know, the stock market going to new highs attracts money in the market, in the stock market. And you know, you look at the S&P and you look at the top 7 or 10 names driving basically everything. You look at the story surrounding AI. You know, there's different stories to tell, and those stories gravitate capital. And you know, you have passive flows that go into, you know, it's almost like a captive amount of money that goes strictly the first 30% goes into the top 7 names or whatever it may be, because that's just how the weighted indexes work. And so you have this, as the higher the markets go, the more money gets sucked from other industries. It goes more into the largest industry, which is technology. And that technology industry just garnishes more and more capital, grows bigger and bigger. And then at some point, you know, that's what, you know, a lot of guys try to watch for is, when do we get so frothy out there? I think one person says it beautifully. It's like max stupid. When does it get to that max stupid point? And I think, yeah, that's what, you know, going through being in the market since 1992, seeing the bubbles that I've seen, I mean, these are manias that are no different. The problem is the mania can be perpetuated longer than you can stay solvent, so to speak. And in, on top of that, you're in an environment, an election environment, that the administration almost seems like they gave the green light to Bitcoin and the markets to go higher and to allow that ETF to almost create this increased wealth effect that's going to basically make people feel wealthier. So they're going to go out and spend more money to try and prop the economy up even more in front of the election. The problem is this is very similar to burning the candle at both ends. You're running at a very unsustainable pace.
Mm-hmm. And Tom, to make it really simple, after we had the pandemic shutdown, I mean, people were freaked out, right? Mm-hmm. People, I mean, their supply chains were shutting down. So people were moving into physical gold and silver, and we saw institutions and retail and hedge funds. And so you had the big increase in the price, you had the big increase in the flows in the GLD, the SLV, and other gold and silver ETFs. After the fear kind of waned, then we start seeing the price come down, flows started going back out, started going down. And then what had happened? We had the Russian-Ukraine war started in March 2022. Same thing happened, fear. And so that we see the flows go back in, price goes back up. And then what happened in mid-2022? The Fed started raising interest rates. And in a very short year and a half, it's up to 5.5%. So just like Bob was saying, it's a change of capital allocation. So the fear is gone now. And so now we've got, you know, everyone's going to be a Bitcoin billionaire. NVIDIA is going to it's going to 5,000. And so this is kind of market psychology. The market psychology is we're going to .com on steroids. And so I think this right now is unfortunate for precious metal investors and the mining industry, because right now the fundamentals to own the metals and even the miners hasn't been better forever. But unfortunately, the current situation has kind of turned it upside down, with the Fed and the U.S. Treasury printing treasuries, you know, $2.4 trillion in just a year. The precious metal investor and even the metals miners have to compete with that. It's very difficult to compete. I call it the gold miners produce gold at about 85%. That's their total cost to get that gold to you. And the silver miners is probably 95%. Well, the U.S. Treasury can sell you a treasury at zero cost. They're just going to print it. And then there may be a transactional fee, what the participants do, and then they're going to service that, right? They're going to pay a service fee, but we can print that too. And so this is what the market participant, the market psychology, isn't really understanding. As I call it, the system is now, a lot of the investors, most of the investors are like a moth heading towards the great financial high-tech NVIDIA flame in the sky. And when the moth gets to that flame, it burns out. But that's really what's happening. The finance is pulling all this money, but it's going to burn people out. And so right now we're in that stage, and it's frustrating when you're a precious metal investor. It really is to see that. But unfortunately, that's where we're at currently.
Yeah, it seems to me that we're at this kind of capitulation moment where demand, sentiment, everything is reaching this rock bottom level. And it seems like really precious metals investors in some ways can't catch a break. Even though gold is doing well, it's almost for the wrong reasons at this point.
Yeah, you may actually have to see, I don't think we're at rock bottom. I think rock bottom would be, you're going to see some of these big dealers go under first. And the market, you got to remember, the industry is not the spot price. The industry is, you know, the premium and discount, you know, associated with a retail bar and coin or industrial bar, like a 1,000-ounce silver bar. But it's not, it doesn't influence the overall price, because, you know, you're dealing with industrial demand, you're dealing with, you know, supply of metal as well from the producer side. So as Steve has pointed out, a lot of these silver producers are barely making any money or not even making money being a primary silver producer. And as he pointed out, they've actually now produced more gold than they do produce silver as a so-called primary silver producer. And so you're seeing shifts even within the industry. But that's what creates lows in the market. When you get that towel being thrown in, that creates value. And this is where I come into the picture, reading all the stuff that I do. And I look at the sentiment and I see, you know, the last 3 years that, you know, you had, you know, basically the retail dealer, the promoter was out there with their fish hook, you know, showing you $10,000 gold and, you know, telling you everything's going to go to the moon. And everyone bit on that. And then, and now you've had just basically a shift of capital flow. And it's not that the story is dead on the precious metals. It's just that money is right now hot in other areas. That right. money will come back. And, but that's where I always tell people, buy the physical metal. I mean, the just for right. fair disclosure, I mean, the hedge fund I manage, 99.4% of the fund is physical metal. It's been like that for a very, very, very long time, really since I transitioned to gold and silver, because the problem with the mining community is the market may take longer the turn than the mining company has solvency to wait it out or the ability to make money while waiting for that moment. And as Steve kind of mentions, and he does really good work on this, he shows where these companies, when they start losing money, they just create more shares and they dilute and they dilute and they dilute. And then all of a sudden, you know, you have some mining executives which are put on a pedestal. They're the greatest thing in the world. They're, you know, they are going to change they're going to break the cartel. They're going to, you know, break the banks and, you know, but in essence, they're just running a business. And if they're losing money, they got to come up with more debt or more equity right. financing to keep it going.
And you see, Tom, that's a shame. Even though you've got better run gold and silver mining companies, some are doing a better job, and then some are getting into newer mines. And so the newer mines can be more profitable, have a lower cost. But then you've got a lot of these older mines, you've got thousands of employees. And so now you see some of these costs, like on Newmont, some of their Canadian mines, they're all in sustaining costs, which isn't the total cost. Some of these you see, it's like nosebleed levels with 17, 19, 2100, all in sustaining costs. So Newmont's, the Fed, the central bank propping up the markets since 2020 pandemic shutdown has really increased producer prices, the producer price index. And now it's really starting to hit a lot of these mines, not just the gold and silver miners, it's hitting everywhere. But the marginal higher cost mines are getting hit the worst. And so their costs are going up much higher. So Newmont is going to, they're going to sell six of their mines because they're too expensive to run them. I mean, it wasn't too expensive to run them 4 years ago. I mean, they were like low 1100, 1200, all in sustaining costs. Now the 17, 18, 1900. And there's not much they can do to bring them down. And so I think this is the unfortunate thing, because the mining industry didn't do that. The central banks did. And so now the mining industry has to pay for that. And so this is the kind of strange dynamic that's not only happening to the precious metal wholesale market, they kind of did that to themselves. Because as Bob and I talk about it, they should tell people to invest in the metals for the mid to long term. Don't tell people it's going to go to $50 silver next month or next week, or gold's going to 5,000. You've got to get into it now. You get into it over time, because the things are going to get just worse. And then you provide good prices. Well, that wasn't the message by most of the precious metal dealer market. It was the exact opposite. You got to get in now, and we're going to overcharge you. And so now it's come back to haunt them. And so this is kind of this dynamic that we're in right now. And I unfortunately, I think it's going to get worse before it gets better.
Yeah. Again, that's where I came out with this post on Twitter or X, you know, about knowing your counterparty. Be very careful out there, because you're dealing with a business environment that most of these companies haven't modeled for. And that's again, you know, just to give people a little bit of background on myself, you know, I run a very large private depository. I created this back in 2008, but I looked at every single facility at the time, and I still look at all the facilities out there. And as far as I can tell, I'm the only facility out there that's not owned by a gold dealer, a financial institution, or a cash and transit company. I don't rely on transaction business to stay alive. We charge a storage fee, and we're a cash flow positive company. And that fee has been modeled to make sure that we can protect the client's assets in any environment. And it, whereas what the model has been really since the, 2017 or so, is a lot of gold dealers open up these storage facilities and depositories thinking, okay, this is going to be the carrot that's going to get us more business. And we're going to charge a lower rate for the depository because therefore we can charge a little bit higher rate on this, on the transaction business, because we're the greatest thing in the world. Well, now that the transaction business has imploded and the profit margins have imploded, the rate that they're charging for the depository isn't enough to cover their day-to-day expenses.
That's a great thing that Bob brought up, and he's really educated me about that. Because I don't really cover the machinations of what's happening, but the system of the precious metal dealer, wholesaler, and storage industry. I look at the mining, the energy, the supply and demand. So he's educated me about that, and it's really kind of shocking because, Bob, what happens if they have to start raising the storage fees? And don't you think that's going to initiate more people to sell that instead of paying? So this could be, because they've designed that business model to live off the transactions and have lower storage fees, if they have to raise these storage fees to become more sustainable, that investors who really don't understand why it's important to own the metals, that could be a motivation to sell more metal at a time when the market doesn't need any more metal.
Right. Or just take delivery and just pull it out all together. And at that point, what's happened is the depository or their main parent company now lost the opportunity to get that metal on the sell transaction. You have to remember, they set up these depositories right to get both sides of the transaction. It's one of the reasons why Wall Street doesn't like gold and silver, because with gold and silver, most people, when they buy it, they don't sell it. You know, to them, it's, we're holding this thing. This is our insurance policy. This is our estate planning. This is going to go to my kids. You know, because it'll outlive us, whatever the notion is. But a lot of times it just passes on from generation to generation. Whether the next generation holds on to it for 50 seconds is another story. but that's the model that the industry woke up to. And it says, listen, we can create the depository. Now we control the transaction flow. Oh, and by the way, if the client wants to borrow against their metal, let's create a business model off of that. Let's be able to allow leverage and then get into the leasing side of the business. So what's happened is, back in 2021, 2022, when interest rates were zero and they were offering these borrow against your gold, because you can take your money out of your gold and you're not going to be hit with capital gains taxes, but you got the capital to use against your collateral. Well, now that interest rates, went up to, it's got raised 5 percentage points, that 5 or 6% loan now is 11 or 12%. So it makes no sense to borrow against your gold anymore. So you got clients that are selling metals or paying off that loan. That's killing the profitability and revenue structure of some of these facilities. And they got to remember, the depository is very capital intensive, low margin business. So it's not that you can just increase the storage fees and lo and behold, you're going to start making more money. That happened in 2015 when you had the breakdown in 2013 of the gold and silver price, and then it just went into basically despair and then finally bottomed in 2015. I was seeing firms raising prices, jacking up their rates to try and stay alive. I mean, I haven't changed the rate that we store metals at since inception. It's been the same rate since I started in 2008, because I understand what it takes to run a business. I don't want to impact the customer because I made a wrong choice. And that's the fiduciary type of role that I kind of, as an investment advisor, I kind of take in, to protect the client's interest. The industry isn't like that. It's not regulated like a banking industry. There's not much compliance. There's not much oversight. And that's where, again, you have to, as a customer or as the public, you have to really read these documents and understand who you're really doing business with. Not just the depository who you're signing your agreement with that may have a very small balance sheet because they really rely on the parent company to really pay all the bills. But your relationship is not with the parent company. Your legal relationship is with that depository, which is a, could be a subsidiary. It could be a separate LLC. It could be a separate company altogether. So, you know, that's what I tried to educate people on is, you know that counterparty.
Mm-hmm. Bob, I was thinking we could cover next another piece of what you were highlighting on Twitter. You mentioned that last week, borrowing costs for the SLV nearly doubled in the last hour of trading. So what is that a symptom of? And give us some perspective for how high that is compared to, you know, other times in, let's say, 2022.
Yeah, the rate has been higher in previous years, especially when you had that big 2021 spike, you know, that silver squeeze sort of movement. You had a very, very big move. I think it was to 7%. I think it was, if I'm not mistaken, the borrowing costs. And so there have been times where it's gotten tighter, meaning the cost to borrow has been more expensive, and maybe at the same time, there have been less shares available to borrow. But what I'm trying to watch for with these borrowing costs is you're looking at the day-to-day sort of activity of the markets. And you know, as money comes into the silver market and you don't see SLV growing 1 ounce in shares outstanding, mm-hmm. at a time when you look at the premium, you know, because the SLV does report its daily premium to its net asset value or its discount to net asset value. When it's at a premium, it actually benefits the authorized participants to deliver cheap metal to the ETF and in exchange for overpriced shares. That's what a premium is to NAV. And then they can sell those overpriced shares to the market and they make money, what they call arbitrage, between the overpriced premium of the shares that they got for the cheaper price of the metal that they deliver it in. So there's that spread that they can make money. They're not doing that here. And in fact, what I'm seeing is if there is any type of inflow of capital that's being directed toward SLV, it's being absorbed by an increasing amount of short sales that's happening in the market. And so the question that you have to look at is, if the market's getting really short and it continues to power through and go higher, which would surprise a lot of people, you can then get what they call a short squeeze start to develop, and you start to see where the market becomes, you know, people aren't expecting that because they're thinking, okay, the metals, you know, the Fed's not raising or lowering rates anytime soon, so why would the metals be going up? I'll just short it. They're not believing in the rally. And that's why I keep saying that the retail isn't believing in this rally either, because they're selling into it as well. It's catching everybody off guard. But that's what bull markets do. The bull markets, by design, will do as much as it can to buck you off. And that's what I think is happening here. We're all ingrained in this trading range scenario in silver that when it gets to 25, 26, you know, sell the farm and buy it back at 22. Well, you just had a breakout in gold, and that breakout in gold has to be respected, I think. And silver is one of those types of metals that when the market starts to broaden, silver plays catch up, and it does it in a very violent fashion. And that's why I'm out there adamantly talking about, you know, the mother of all, you know, short covering rallies that we could potentially be seeing.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you a question, Bob. I do agree with you. Do you think this rally is a sustainable long-term bull market rally?
That's actually a really good question, because the hard part with all of us is we don't know what's going to come about from the election. I mean, you may see, this is how bull markets work. The price starts going up for no reason whatsoever. And you're thinking, why is this thing going up? It's just going to go right back down. There's no real effect, mm-hmm. or cause that will drive this market higher. You know, nobody's making money or whatever the reason is. But, you know, 9 months down the road, you have an event that happens. And it's like, well, how the hell did the gold market see that event? Well, that's how investors behave. You know, they start looking at, okay, what could be coming down the road that could be the reason for, you know, whether it be an election issue, a political uncertainty, could it be a currency crisis, could it be, you know, this burning the candle at both ends, which is completely unsustainable. If you don't have the tax revenue base, we're going to go into more deficit spending, which is going to be counterproductive, and it's going to have to create more fiscal sort of dominance, I guess you could say. I mean, there's these rabbit holes that you can go down with, but they don't play themselves out in the next hour. It happens over time. So you could be a $30 silver, and then all of a sudden the election, something happens with the election or some crazy event happens in the world, and they're like, this has just changed the face of investing, or the outlook of investors' confidence to saying, well, listen, maybe I don't believe in the technology and the AI isn't as great as what I thought it was going to be. Or, I mean, look at Bitcoin. I mean, Bitcoin has gone through the roof, but the miners have gone through the floor. I guess I don't even think you could say they've gone through the floor because it's all digital. So I don't know what you call it, but it's absolutely truly amazing to look at how can Bitcoin be sustainable when it's not even profitable to create the block of which, you know, the foundation of Bitcoin is all about. You know, it's turned into this speculative frenzy, which is fine. I mean, and that grabs a lot of hot capital. But like you said, the question is, how sustainable is it over time? And when you see something go price vertical, that, in my opinion, is the time that you want to be very careful in the marketplace. And that's where, oddly enough, you know, the metals are moving up because, you know, maybe it's a bubble. Everything's floating higher now. But you know, you may be seeing markets pull away, taking allocations out of what's been running and what's been hot. That maybe they're moving back into the metals. Maybe they're going back into non-correlated assets, you know, with the S&P 500, or, you know, they're concerned and they see what's going to happen 6 months from now, or they, you know, what they envision and what their models are telling them. And that could be what's driving the metals at this point. But it's not going to appear like an open book today. That's the hard part about investing in the markets. And that's why I try to at least help people educate them of why events are happening day to day, so they can kind of at least say, okay, well, this is why the market took a dump, or this is why the market took off. And I can understand that. But again, holding the physical metal over the long term, you're buying it not for the next 6 weeks, you're buying it for the next couple of years. And that's the beauty of the physical metal. It doesn't have an expiration to it. We can sit on this thing and we can be patient and wait.
And Tom, Bob wrote up a good point about Bitcoin miners. Mm-hmm. And I've done some research on it. If we think that the gold and silver miners have underperformed the silver gold price, which they have, due to cost, the Bitcoin miners, it's like times two, times three. Wow. And it's really strange to see Bitcoin go to 72,000 and Marathon, Riot Platforms, and CleanSpark, which are the top three traded Bitcoin miners in the United States. Matter of fact, those are the biggest miners, public miners in the world, to see their prices fall. It's very fascinating to see that dynamic, because the gold and silver miners tend to go up with the price, which they have recently, even though they've been selling off with this last price spike. Newmont, Barrick, all the gold miners have gone up in pretty good percentage. The Bitcoin miners have done the exact opposite.
You could also mention the dilution, how much these Bitcoin miners, it diluted themselves over the last 3 years since the last peak or when they came public.
Yeah, Tom, the market cap is about $12 billion for these top three Bitcoin miners. Since 21 to 23, they've done $4 billion in share dilution.
Wow.
Because I don't know if they could get, maybe they just could not get the financing from banks. So they decided to use their shareholders to fund their business, because, Tom, a Bitcoin miner has got to be replaced every 4 years. Mm-hmm. Basically, you're replacing the Bitcoin mining industry every 4 years. Very capital intensive.
So do you think that we can chalk that up to these capital flows where people are more interested in the underlying asset rather than supporting the miners that are actually doing the work to provide that service?
I think so. And I hear it all the time. People say, oh, Steve, thanks for showing me. I'm not going to invest in gold and silver miners. The question is, you're correct right now. Mm-hmm. But my analysis shows that the U.S. Treasury printing and issuing treasuries as the number one collateral, it isn't collateral. The market psychology believes it so right now. That's going to change. The real collateral is the physical gold and silver. And so when you go to a future, and I think that's coming, where the market's going to change the psychology, because you can't keep increasing finance because we don't have the energy to settle it, then treasuries get in trouble, bonds get into trouble. And so you have to find out what is the real collateral. Mm-hmm. And the real collateral, it really is gold and silver. And so who provides that collateral? The gold and silver miners. So right now they're unloved, the costs are increasing, but at some point in time, they will be the ones who will be issuing the real treasury, the real collateral. And that's when I believe their stock prices are going to behave a lot like what you see in tech stocks. But that's still some time away.
Mm-hmm. So guys, let's get into some listener questions. I went on Twitter and asked a bunch of listeners, or you know, anybody that wanted to ask a question, you know, things that are on people's minds. So let's start with this one. What is the catalyst to get the much needed retail and public engagement in precious metals? Bitcoin and miners are risk on and the public is enthralled. Retailers are not sensing big upside in precious metals versus Bitcoin. If the S&P starts dropping, it will at some point. Will PMs benefit or suffer also?
Yeah, I think part of that answer is money chases money, or money chases rising prices, I should say, momentum. And that's been since the beginning of time. So you have to have an asset dislocation or asset market dislocation, shake up the prevailing wind, so to speak, you know, whether it be because of you know, these companies have, they're so expensive that they're priced for absolute perfection. And the last guy just bought the last share. And now, okay, now you're going to start this, you know, selling bonanza. You know, it could be an event. I mean, you got to remember the metals are very odd asset classes that they don't necessarily need a booming stock market. They just need a catalyst or an event that drives confidence. And that's what actually brings in a lot of money into this asset class. The problem is the industry took advantage of that investor trust or that investor's mm-hmm. confidence the last 3 years. And I think if they would have done a better job of managing that flow and not making as much money as they did, I think they would have balanced the market you know, over time a lot better. But instead, you know, it just it became a bonanza, and they profited heavily from it. I think from the retail perspective, you're going to need a shakeup, or from the investor perspective, you're going to need something that shakes their confidence. And that typically is going to be some type of market event, or you're going to have some political event, you know, whether it's geopolitical or whether it's, you know, an election issue, or whether it's, you know, just simply, hey, listen, the whether it's the current administration just spending like a drunken sailor, and we're just going to, you know, keep this market as high as possible or as steady as possible to the election. And then once the election happens, you know, everything just falls apart. It may take for that to happen. And that's when you finally see the recession that a lot of people were watching for. If that happens, I think and the metals could be anticipating this. They could be saying, listen, we see the eventuality of the dollar is going to have to go down. It's going to have to be devalued or at least inflated away in order to, like Steve mentioned, maintain those costs of servicing the debt. And so the administration is, you know, that's why, you know, they could juice the stock market, and then all of a sudden they get a lot of tax revenue based from it, from capital gains and so forth, and all, you know, wealth taxes but spending from that wealth creation, I guess you could say, or that wealth effect. But ultimately you're going to need some dislocation, and that then sets up for, you know, whatever the asset class that's been underperforming, you tend to get that shift going back into the other direction. It's like watching a bathtub where the water just flows back and forth from side to side. Very similar. The financial markets work very similarly.
Anything to add there, Steve?
I agree. It is a market dislocation. And, you know, my analysis is it's going to be energy driven. That's the factor. Because I've been talking about natural gas. If you think you're frustrated owning silver, which is at 24 or 25, which is five times higher than it was in 1998, natural gas is the same price it was in 1998. So with that being said, who's manipulating the natural gas market? Nobody is. That's just the unfortunate symptom of shale gas production. And we could even see much lower natural gas prices. We could see a very big problem in the next several months. And so the problem comes when it all turns around, Tom, and it goes back the other way. The energy cliff is very volatile on the way up and down. It's now on the way down, especially for natural gas. But when it starts to move back up, then we're going to see much more inflation in the system. And so I say that the dislocation starts to pick upstream when energy constraints really puts a lot of pressure on all that finance. And that's treasuries, that's pension plans, that's IRAs, that's the stock market, that's the bond market. That's when that starts to get into trouble. The market psychology starts to wake up and says, well, you know, do I want to keep my money in there and get a 5% interest? I may not get that money back. And that's a very good question to ask. Right now, it's assumed you're always going to get that money back of your treasury. But what if that money does not come back or it's worth much less? Mm-hmm. That's when the market psychology moves back into the metals. And that's when I see a sustained rally and bull market, even with when ETF demand takes off, whether it's leased metal, whatever, they don't have the metal in there, I don't care, because that's what the market's going to do. I can't control that market. But when you get retail people selling NVIDIA and getting into an ETF gold, because it's easy for them to do that, that's going to happen. Central banks will be buying more gold. We're going to have massive demand for physical. When all those happen at the same time, when the psychology starts to change, we're in the wrong collateral, we're in the wrong finance, that's when we're going to see this massive dislocation. But that could happen before, when you start getting instances of it, as Bob is talking about, like we may be seeing now. But the real driver will be when all those forces start to move into a very small amount of gold and silver and mining shares.
Mm-hmm. And you have to remember too, central banks have been big buyers, you know, not just, you know, 1 year out of the last 15. I mean, they've been ramping up their buying, and that's what's been also supporting the gold market as well. And that could be also, you know, them buying and being net buyers could also be why the ETF flows are negative, meaning that metal that could have been leased metal from a bullet from a central bank to a bullion bank delivered to an ETF to create the shares to absorb right. capital flow when money was coming in, now that's in reverse. And so the ETFs don't necessarily dominate the marketplace. You know, right. the futures markets have more impact on price than the ETF structures do. It's just that initially, when you have so much capital flow coming in, it does have an effect, no question. But you know, when you get into some serious volatility, especially when you deal with leverage in the futures markets, you're dealing with a compounding effect of paper prices over a physical item. So, and that's why a lot of people say, well, God, you have this, you know, 84-1 leverage effect of, you know, in the London cash market or the London paper market trades 84 times the mining supply, for example, of whatever silver's mined that year. I mean, there's just a massive amount of volume on the paper side that tends to whip these prices all over the place.
And Tom, let me clarify. When I say I think we're going to see a lot of demand going to the ETFs, I don't think that's a wise decision to do. I'm not saying it's something that people, but I can't control what the market does. And so most of the money is in the equities and in the finance. So it's very easy to point and click and change where you have money and move it somewhere else. Mm-hmm. Of course, Bob is right. It's very smart to buy physical metal, but most of the market isn't wise that way. They tend to point and click and buy these ETFs. And so all I'm saying is that's going to be a driver too. Whether it's a positive driver for the physical, it will be a major driver when all these tend to confluence together. And so that's all I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. I think this is where I'm trying to educate the institution and high net worth, right. ultra high net worth investor, is that the ETFs and structured products that Wall Street puts out, the client is actually the product. They're not buying the product. So Wall Street makes money off of them. And when the right. client starts to understand what these ETFs are, you don't legally own anything. You're not even the legal owner of the shares. You're a beneficial owner, because the legal owner of all the shares that's held in street name is a seeding company, which is an LP of the Depository Trust Clearing Corporation. When people start to understand the counterparty risk and systemic risk environment right. that we're in, and like Steve mentions beautifully with regard to collateral and how the metals are pristine collateral because it's no one else's liability. That's what you're right. buying when you buy gold and silver. It's a reason why it doesn't pay interest, because it doesn't have any risk when you hold it directly. That's what I'm trying to educate the institutional investor on. And it's very difficult because a lot of institutional investors have, you know, these committees that they have to abide by and these policies that they have to follow that says you have to be in a security or a fund. You can't be an actual a physical asset. Or if you're going to go into a physical asset, you got to get approval from 15 different people. And then you have to look at the carrying costs of that asset and how you're going to value it versus where if you just hold an ETF in a brokerage account, lo and behold, the auditor just goes to the daily price and he can say, well, that's the fair price of that. You don't have to market or anything like that, some of these illiquid assets. The system is designed and it's centralizing assets. So institutions are in a funnel and the treasury market is at the top of the centralization. You know, by allowing banks to hold treasuries, you know, during that COVID time where they didn't have to apply those treasury holdings to their reserve requirements and that type of thing, they were taking money away from the mom and pop banks, or I would say taking money away from the economy, because banks weren't incentivized to make loans to an entrepreneur. They were incentivized to hold, you know, a 5% yielding treasury or a 2% yielding treasury at the time. And so that is cannibalizing productivity and growth. And the sad part about this is I think the market's going to, and you see the same thing with the S&P 500. The bigger companies are just getting bigger and bigger and bigger because that's the weighting and the passive 60-40 portfolio and all that other stuff that's going on. Once that breaks, you know, and that's why you need market dislocations, it tends to start to clean out the excess of the markets, of an industry, whatever it may be, of the financial markets. You need that cleansing. It's actually a very healthy thing. And then that then inspires change and a change in environment and culture and behavior. The metals will be that point during that change, when from point A to point B, and that sort of chaos is that's in between those two points, that's when the metals will flourish. And I think that's when they become overvalued relative to other assets. And at that point, you use the metals for a funding mechanism to go into another undervalued relative asset or relative valued asset. But it's a process that takes time. It needs to work itself through the system. Mm-hmm.
And Tom, in just the last year, I've said this a few times, the U.S. Treasury has added 2.4 trillion new treasuries. Now, they had to settle old ones and reissue, but new above and beyond since the end of 2022, it was 2.4 trillion for 2023. Get this, to understand what collateral is, the total gold mining industry has added about 230 billion worth of gold. So it's one tenth. The US Treasury printed 2.4 trillion in treasuries. The market absorbed those. They're getting a nice interest rate. Unfortunately, the gold mining industry only added, and that's just the US. We're not talking about the ECB, Japan, China. So when you add 2.4 trillion of new treasuries at zero cost compared to 230 billion of gold, there's just no comparison. And so I think I don't think the market really understands. And that's why I talked to Bob, because it's frustrating, Tom. It's frustrating to see the market continue to absorb that finance. And it's like they're getting out of the frying pan and they're going into the fire. And I do agree with Bob. Institutions should not go into these ETFs, these gold and silver ETFs, because they should own the physical metal. That's the safest thing to own. That's the safest collateral. There's no counterparty risk. But this is a very crazy market right now.
Guys, we have a handful of questions here. Really wanting to know these shifts from east to west. So let's start with any validity of a gold versus silver east-west split.
I'm not aware of that. The bimetallic standard kind of went out the window a long time ago. From an industrial standpoint, you know, you're seeing that demand from India, you know, especially for solar panel and, you know, manufacturing activity, you know, and then of course jewelry demand, that type of thing. But you know, from a monetary standpoint, you know, silver taking a role next to gold, I don't really see that as the cause of moving silver. I mean, if that did happen, that's great, and it actually would probably strengthen the silver market quite a bit. Not necessarily from a standpoint of just the price goes through the roof. I think it would create more stability in the price itself. But that's part of what we're seeing with the Basel III, that deleveraging that we've been seeing with the banking sector getting out of a lot of these sort of structured products and unallocated gold programs and silver programs being disincentivized to basically use the bank's balance sheet to say, listen, I have a client that wants to buy an unallocated gold position. Well, they're not really buying gold. They're just buying the liability of the bank's balance sheet is what they're doing. Well, by making that more expensive, the banks have got away from that business. You know, they're reducing their trading desk exposure and that type of thing. And that's again, that's helping the physical market try to become more dominant in sort of price action, I guess you could say. And we've seen that with, you know, this decline in open interest since the COVID March or since the 2020 highs. You know, the open interest and volumes have been steadily going down. I mean, there's a lot of positives to Asia building their markets up. But I think it's, you know, it's one of those things that's going to be kind of funny because you may see where Asia is a big buyer of metals right now, and then we go through our dislocation, we become a big buyer, and then you have their people buying their stock market. I mean, yeah, it things just move in cycles. It doesn't stay stagnant forever.
Which geopolitical players have an interest in keeping the price down?
I don't know. That's a tough question. To me, the central banks are buying it for a reason. They're supporting the price. They're supporting the metal because they either need the inflation to deal with their current debt structure and their structural currency issues that they have, and this sort of inflate or die scenario that basically every country's kind of joined in on. So they need some type of anchor. But at the same time, gold, if gold continues to rise, I think, which is kind of interesting that gold's breaking out to new highs. Usually when gold does this, it's usually something weird that's going on in the world, not rainbows and unicorns. So I think maybe there's a change in attitude that says, listen, maybe we need a higher gold price to promote this inflationary type of outlook to basically deal with this massive amount of debt and debt servicing that's ultimately going to hit us like a tidal wave at some point.
And Tom, I don't think there are really any geopolitical leaders or countries that are trying to cap the gold price
that necessarily overtly care about
it. Yeah. Now, in your last question, the West has been more dominant in gold. India and China, they've been the typical buyers. And the central banks up until 2008, it's mostly been the Western central banks that were net sellers. So after 2008, when central banks came net buyers, there's still selling going on every year by central banks, but the net buying is more. It's mostly been either Asian European, Eastern European countries, Russia, China, those are the ones buying Indonesia. Those are the ones buying the gold. Mm-hmm. And so it's not Western. Germany isn't buying gold. US isn't buying. France isn't buying gold. It isn't the Western countries. Australia is not buying gold. God knows Canada isn't buying any gold. And so the thing is, but the West, the US has been the biggest consumer or investor of silver, mm-hmm. especially bullion. It's been the West. The United States is number one. So I think going forward, I do think Bob is right. It's been Asia because Indians typically, they buy gold. That's been a foundation of their society to buy gold. China buys gold. They don't buy much silver as an investment. And so now I think that can change because Germany was buying a lot of gold last year, a lot of gold. And so I think that will change when we have this dislocation. It's going to start moving back to the West as because the West has most of the finance. Even though China has a lot of debt and finance, the West has most of the finance. That's where most of the trouble is. Mm-hmm.
There's a couple of questions in here, but I think the general theme of it we can pick away at. Is the East setting the price on gold now? Is there real evidence that silver is suppressed? I hear that silver is abundant and that there's more than enough. And I hear that it's very rare due to the lack of mining and industrial / military use, which is true. Can the silver price, quote unquote, get away from banks?
It's a real complicated type of answer because, you listen to promoters out there and gold dealers. Yeah, they're going to espouse the conspiracy and, you know, the metals are the anti-dollar and you know there's a motive to smash the price you know because maybe those metals are a sort of a barometer of fear or instability in the marketplace. I think what's happening, and I've done a lot of work on this, talking about how silver gets sold into the market and dominated by the paper price action. It's not necessarily the banks that always say, listen, we're going to just crap on this metal whenever we have a chance. And we can wake up at 6:30 in the morning. And you know, the first thing we're going to do is just sell the price no matter what's been doing overnight. The problem that you have is the structural theme that's in the silver market. When silver comes, that 1 ounce comes out of the ground from a mine, the moment it comes out of the ground, it's hedged. Means it's sold into the market on paper and then delivered to the next guy. It's like a hot potato. And so then it's sold to a smelter or refiner. What when the refiner melts it down and they now have title and ownership over it, they're going to hedge the price because they don't want to see their profit margins get smashed. So then they sell it to an industrial user, or they sell it to the wholesaler for a 1,000 ounce bar, or they sell it to whatever it may be. But the next guy they sell it to, that guy goes into the market and hedges and sells a futures contract. And so you have this, like, 1 ounce is probably sold 5 different times through its life cycle before it gets to the end user, which then either uses it or just simply hoards it and simply holds on to it, you know, whether it's retail product or jewelry, whatever it may be. That's part of the problem, is that the paper markets are so pervasive. On the second part of it, the precious metals are a financial asset. They're collateralized and they're financialized. There's money to be made in using those metals as a way to gain loans, to use them for leverage, to use for leasing. I mean, there's different themes that you can use metals for, you know, on Wall Street or in London that then add more into the paper market's importance of hedging and transactional building and so forth. So that then adds more paper ounces into the market, even though that physical ounce still sits in maybe the same vault that it did. It's now being borrowed against or used as collateral to buy something else. All those types of functions have an impact on the precious metals markets. And that's what I'm trying to maybe educate people on, is it's larger than just simply JP Morgan holding all the silver for the SLV ETF, or you know, they have a custodial vault that holds a lot of eligible and registered metal for potentially other clients, you know, whether they hold some in their own name on their own balance sheet, that's a whole different argument. But a lot of players use the metals for business and for security transactions, and that tends to add more, you know, optionality flow and futures and forwards and swaps and a lot of different financial transactions that tend to have impact on the price. If that helps.
Go ahead.
Oh, Steve. This is kind of important because I do agree with Bob. There's a lot of that paper trading. The issue is, Why would the price be 22 today or 24, 25 today with all that paper hedging and trading and options and all that when it was 5 just about 15, 20 years ago? Mm-hmm. Well, if you look at the cost of production, it's now full cost is 22. So there's some underlying factors that's taking place along with this very complicated hedging trading market. You could trade thousands of, you know, paper shares are just trading, churning out. But, you know, why is the price of silver now at 25? and the gold price is at 2,100. Well, the cost of production now is 1,700. The total cost, total cost of silver is 22. I'm not saying that. You look at the companies, and that's what it costs now. So if you take 1,700, you divide by 22, you get 78-1. Voila. The gold-silver ratio has been between 75, 80, 85-1. Now, I'm not saying that's the right way to value gold and silver. That's how the algorithms in this entire crazy complex market is currently trading gold and silver. And they're trading it based on the cost of production, because why can't the price of gold now be $1,000 with all this thousands of trading and hedging and options? Well, you would bankrupt 90% of the gold market. And then they can't supply any more gold, because they can't produce gold at $1,000 an ounce anymore. And so I think people need to understand these foundational things that are impacting the value of gold. And that could be inflation. That could be, you know, the money is being printed and the debasement of the currency. It's all part of it. So going forward, the problem is that the only thing, the difference is, it's trading at this 22. That's kind of the floor for silver. The upside potential is not because it's being manipulated down, is because the manipulation is taking place by adding all the paper and all the finance and all the derivatives. That's the manipulation. Mm-hmm. And so when that gets into trouble, then you start going back into silver. And that's when you start to see the real foundational. And I do agree with when a lot of the let's say the pumpers of the metals, I do agree there's manipulation. It's just not in the way they think it is. Mm-hmm. The manipulation is keeping the financial market alive. And that's where and that's where everyone's going right now. They're all heading into the finance. And so I just wanted to add to clarify why the gold and silver price keep going up, even though we have all this churning of the paper assets. It's due to what it costs to produce it.
Mm-hmm. One other thing too, Tom, is that the futures market is designed to be a seller's market. It is a hedger's market. That was its original foundation. So we all look at the futures market as a price setting mechanism, but in reality, it's there for players to sell their paper contracts against a physical underlying position that they actually own. And that's unfortunate, because that physical position is taken out of the market and it's already absorbed. It's gone. It's not coming into the market, but it's the paper action of that selling of that futures contract that drives the price down. And that's the frustration I think a lot of the retail individuals see out there, is they think, my God, this thing is just manipulated. It's never going to go higher. But it's just that we're all looking at an exchange that's based on really the drive of a hedger or a seller of the market, not necessarily a buyer. People don't go to the futures markets, you know, to go long and buy, because it's a margin. It's a leverage market. You put 10% down and you can control, you know, 100% of whatever the notional value is. The CTAs, that's why I watch the CTAs and the managed money on the commitment or traders report so much, is that when those guys get too oversided or too long or too short or on one side of the boat too much, that's when the market tends to shift and you see this movement in price back in the other direction, because they have too much exposure and the market's done at that point going in that direction. Then they got to start unwinding and it starts shifting the market back in the other direction. That part of the market is just commodity trading advisors sort of gaming the momentum of a move of an asset, whether it's gold or silver or oil or cocoa beans or whatever it may be. They're just looking at price action. They don't care about the underlying. They're never going to take delivery of the asset. They're just saying, listen, if the economy is going to be strong, and rates are going to be low, I'm going to buy silver. But if the economy is going to go in the toilet and industrial production or industrial usage of silver is going to go down, I'm going to go short silver no matter what, you know, the dollar's doing. I mean, there's certain, like Steve was saying, there's algorithms that these guys use to perform those trades with. But that's just another side function of the futures market.
What is the short-term consequence to the price of silver when such shorting happens? I'm assuming this was in response to shorting the SLV, as you were pointing out, Bob.
Yeah. When you look at the real short-term day-to-day activity, what you're trying to gauge is, you know, the flow of the market. Is it is market makers or professionals able to, I don't say control the price, but able to kind of allow the market to breathe, but not break out to the upside? Meaning, will people exhaust themselves by buying? And then once that buying exhaustion happens and professionals come in and short the market where they're buying at a high price, expecting it to drop, that's what you try to watch for. The problem is when the market finally, you know, a lot of people get in this sort of complacency when you get caught in a trading range and it goes from 22 to 26, 22 to 26. Professionals get used to that trading range and they're going, okay, this thing's at 24 and a half, 25. We're starting to get into the red zone here. Okay, let's increase our bets. So it goes to 25 and a half. They're thinking, okay, we got about 50 cents more. Let's be full position by the time it hits 26 because, baby, it's going down. But the moment that breaks out, you get a lot of people caught on the wrong side. And that breakout can be very, very instrumental and explosive. And silver happens to be one of those asset classes that when that breakout occurs, it can move like a hockey stick. And we all get frustrated. We're watching the price. It's going absolutely nowhere. Everyone's like, this is the worst investment in the world. I've been sitting on this thing since the beginning of time. I'm watching Bitcoin go up 5X. I'm watching Nvidia go up 20X, whatever the hell the thing is going on at the time. But that's when people give up. But that's usually about the time. The
worst time.
Yes, that's when the market wakes up, and there's an old adage in the stock market that I learned: you never short a dull market. And when the market gets dull, it's just that the selling dries up. And so when you have people that are artificially selling into the market, and there isn't any more people to sell, and so those guys can't cover anymore, the market has one direction to go. That's usually when it breaks out. That's what I try to watch for. And, you know, and again, I try to use Twitter is a way to try to help inform people of market conditions, you know, what to maybe watch for, not necessarily trying to cheerlead the market like a lot of people do, but just try to help people understand what's happening and maybe what to watch for.
During the GME squeeze, GME shares were 140% rehypothecated. Are there similar bizarre statistics for the GLD or SLV units?
Well, the difference with SLV and GLD is those are ETFs. They're not fixed number of shares. So right. More metal can be brought into the shares by the authorized participant to create more shares. So in essence, I know during the silver squeeze, you know, you had that, you know, addition into the prospectus that said, listen, there could be a chance that we may not be able to go out and find more silver. And if that happens, there's a possibility that the silver ETF could trade at a very high premium to its status of value. And that becomes a risk because now you have this sort of so-called spread risk or NAV risk where you buy it too high as a premium, that premium could drop just like when you buy a retail product. That premium can fall out of bed. So if you're paying an extra 10% for something that's worth, you know, instead of, you know, you pay $11 when it's actually worth 10, for example, when that premium dries up and goes back to 10, you aren't going to get back that dollar. It may never go back to that premium again. And that's part of the issue that I have with the PSLV and it's set up as a closed end fund where it's not an ETF. It doesn't have authorized participants adding shares or adding metal, creating shares, redeeming shares and market makers to sort of that have an arbitrage profit mechanism, an incentive to make a market for that product. In the PSLV, it's a closed-end fund. So when they do an offering, an at-the-market offering, they're usually selling those shares when the market spikes up in price, because the reason why they do that is most of the time it trades at a discount to NAV. And the only way they can actually increase the number of shares outstanding is if they are allowed under Canadian law to look at the prior day's closing NAV price and use that price as the factor of whether it's trading at a discount or premium at the current real-time market the next day. So if you have this big spike in price, and say, let's say, you know, PSLV is at $7 closing, and its net asset value is $6 and say $7.20, they can't issue any stock until it gets over $7.20 on the real time price. But the problem is, when they issue those shares, you say the silver goes up 30 cents an ounce, or say the NAV, the share price goes up 30 cents, the price of silver actually goes up as well. So now they're having to buy silver back, silver at a higher price, and they only can bring in the net asset value, the whatever the proceeds from the aftermarket offering, they can only bring that in based on the prior day's closing price. So you basically get prior day's closing price proceeds to buy wherever the spot price of the metal is trading today, which is higher. And that's why that fund typically buys on pullbacks, because otherwise it becomes extremely dilutive if they're constantly having to issue shares artificially during a spike in price, and then go out and buy the silver at even a higher price than what their proceeds were that they were taking in.
Steve, anything to add there?
No, I think he's correct. Bob tends to follow the what's happening more on the premiums and the shorting on the ETFs. I tend to think the issue going forward is, if we do see a lot of demand come in for the SLV and they don't have, there will be a time they won't have the metal, that premium is going to go up. I think because there's so much money in the market, there's so many money funds in the market, when it tries to move into an ETF, which isn't the right thing to do, Bob has explained why, it's better to have your own physical, you're going to get that huge premium. But the problem is, I think there could come a point where the ETF may actually pull up the spot price on the exchanges, because you may see so much demand go into ETFs due to this change in market psychology. Again, this is just a speculation. Either way, it's important. I see this kind of short-term, let's say short covering rally, the spike. I think it's more short term. I could be wrong. Bob might be more right. This could be more of a sustainable thing we don't know about. But that doesn't mean people don't need to be in the metals or continue to buy into the metals, because I don't know what's going to happen. And I try to look at the same spike in gold and silver, because my analysis, Tom, is if, when we get the correction in the markets, I think it pulls everything down. And we're not even there yet. I mean, the S&P is still almost at near highs. The NASDAQ is almost at near highs. The Dow Jones is. So we haven't even had the correction in the broader markets yet. So that's what I tell my subscribers. Even though we're going to see higher prices, I still think we're going to get that correction when the markets correct. But I don't think it's going to be a short-lived correction in the metals. So that's the only thing I'm concerned about. Before that, I think we could see even higher paper prices.
What steps are involved when APs or authorized participants want to remove their metal from the GLD or SLV? Yeah. I often hear that they borrow/lease instead of buy units to do this. But then what happens when borrowed units are extinguished? How does this affect the premium or discount?
Yeah, I know we did almost a whole spaces on ETFs. I think I linked it in my article. To kind of give a little bit of refresher course, when an authorized participant is hired to become an authorized participant with that ETF sponsor, what their job is to do is to help stabilize the NAV and meet market demand for that product. So they'll typically have inventory. Let's say, for example, silver, they'll have an underlying instrument. So they use silver, for example. They will deliver that silver to the fund, and they do it through basically a mechanism of which they may hold the silver in London at JP Morgan, for example, in their account, say broker dealer, you know, A, for example. They then give that metal through the custodian of the ETF, that metal goes into what they call an unallocated position for a very short period of time. And then it's brought back into the ETF's account in an allocated type of format. So it's held in the name of the ETF. And then what happens is the authorized participant gets shares in exchange for the underlying instrument. And then they go out and they sell those shares into the market. Or, you know, they may be an authorized participant who has a broker dealer arm that creates structured products. And so they may need those shares to create the structured product to then, you know, use that as a benchmark vehicle to sell to an institution where an institution wants an indexing type of play on the price of silver. They use SLV, for example, as that indexing type of instrument. So what happens is then you have the market moving up and down. It's breathing in the marketplace. The price goes up, price goes down. But the NAV of the fund can jostle against the underlying silver itself. So sometimes people come in and they buy a lot of SLV shares. That may push the price up artificially higher than the actual underlying. So you have what they call a premium. So the market makers incentivized to say, listen, I'm going to deliver more silver to that ETF, create more shares, and then I'm going to go ahead and sell those shares at that premium to that institution or investor that wants to buy. And then on the vice versa side, let's just say you have a whole bunch of selling going on and the SLV goes to a discount to NAV. So now the SLV shares are cheaper than the relative metal. The market makers incentivized to buy those shares in the open market at a discount, deliver the shares back, and get the more expensive metal in return and pocket that spread between the discounted shares to the higher, more expensive metal. And they can use other methods of stabilizing the price of the NAV of the fund to the premium or discount that it's trading at the time. So you can even have a situation where, let's say the shares of the fund are trading at a steep discount to the price of silver or the net asset value. You may have authorized participants sell metal in the open market to drive the price down of the underlying instrument of the asset itself, and then buy shares in the SLV with no intention of delivering those shares, but they use the two assets as a paired leg, I guess you could say, or a pair, where they're buying one asset and selling the other, so they're somewhat price neutral. But the idea behind it is to try and drive the NAV or that the ETF closer to its actual NAV and away from that maybe bigger premium or discount. They're incentivized to make that sort of arbitrage profit.
Anything to add, Steve?
No. He explains it perfectly. I think it's very difficult to, wouldn't you think, Bob, it's difficult to manage these ETFs and do it correctly?
It takes a very captive marketplace. And that's where I think it gets frustrating, because that's, I think, where a lot of the management of the market, through market makers, there's a lot of sort of, I hate the word manipulation, because manipulation it involves some form of deceit and illegality, that type of thing. But there's management that I think every market out there is managed. There's no question about it. To say that the gold and silver market isn't managed is closing your eyes to what's going on. The problem is there is an incentive, an arbitrage incentive, a lot of instances to help manage the market in ways that profits the market makers or the authorized participants or the ETF sponsor, whatever it may be. And that tends to get really frustrating when you're dealing with a commodity, because at the end of the day, the commodity doesn't really have the sway of moving the price. It's the paper instruments that are jostling the market around that are actually influencing that price.
How much gold and silver is really moving from west to east? We've kind of covered this a little bit, but
yeah,
I think it would be interesting to make a little bit more explicit.
Well, if you look at what the World Gold Council and what the Silver Institute, if you believe their data, some people don't believe it, but it's the best data you can really go by. The West tends to continue to buy most of the gold. India tends to buy gold, but they tend to buy more bars, silver bars, when the price drops. See, they're savvy. They tend to buy silver when it declines. Americans in the West tend to buy silver, you know, when it goes down, but also when it's rising. They're not doing that now. So the issue is we are seeing gold flow more towards the West. Central banks are buying more to the East. And I'm so sorry. We've seen gold go to the East. It's going to the East. More silver tends to go to the West. But that's kind of the way it's been going for about 10, 15 years now. It really hasn't changed. The dynamics haven't changed. When we get into the pandemic shutdown, we saw more going to the West. And so, and I think, as Bob has mentioned, when we get more dislocations, we're going to see a lot more move to the West than the East, because again, most of the finance is there. But again, it's the Eastern central banks that tend to buy most of the gold. It's not the Western central banks. So that does continue to flow East.
I think it's also important to note that you have to distinguish between the coin and bar market versus the institutional or central bank level of buying. And I think, you know, what I try to do is help people understand that, like, for example, Singapore, which is, you know, their central bank's been buying gold. But if you look at the last couple of years, there have been periods in Singapore where the market's just absolutely dead. On a retail level, the bids have been extremely poor. It's been been very expensive logistically to move metal over there to get it back. So you have a lot less business flow on the retail side of metal going to Singapore. The U.S. still is very dominant in terms of the retail and investor crowd. In terms of product flow and the amount of volume being traded, the U.S. is still one of the largest markets out there. We store in Singapore as well, but we've been pulling, really since COVID, we've been pulling clients back out of Singapore for numerous reasons, but mainly because of, you know, I saw Singapore as really a great country, you know, prior to COVID, as one that was very forward looking. The legal system is excellent, the education system is excellent, but when COVID happened and all of a sudden basically the government shut everything down, you had to go into quarantine, you know, into a hotel room for 10 days before you could even enter into the country. The whole idea of using a location outside of your home country is, you know, your ability to get there. And we saw what happened in COVID, a very prime example of what could happen in a dislocation type of environment. And I just didn't like the reaction that I saw. So, and neither did most of the clients. So we decided to start just, you know, moving back out of there. But again, that's where, you know, someone like myself that deals with high net worth clients, retail clients, institutional clients, that's the type of sort of education that I provide. It's not just simply, you know, how many, you know, ounces of metal do you have in our depository. It's really, you know, what the market is doing, you know, what we're seeing in the environment out there, you know, in the not only in the markets, but also the regulatory environment, as well as in terms of, you know, in the legal environment, you know, the flow of customs and duties and taxes and all that kind of stuff. You have to really know, there's a lot to know in the gold and silver space. It's not just simply, you know, buying and selling and storing. You know, there's, you know, a lot of sort of help that you have to provide the customer, because for a lot of people, they're new to this market and there's a lot of questions that they're going to have, and you want to make sure that they're ultimately making the right decision the first go around. You don't want to have to move this metal around two or three different times.
Absolutely. Because that just increased costs, exposure, everything.
Yeah, your risks. I mean, it's, you know, you look at, for example, the instance where you had North Korea lobbying missiles over Japan. Well, all of a sudden, you know, that just created a massive amount of risk. Or Taiwan, you know, what happens if China invades Taiwan? You know, people think, well, I'll just, you know, I store my metals in Singapore. Well, try getting over there. You know, if you get into, like, you know, it's just like taking a tanker into the Red Sea, you know, yeah, life changes, and insurance companies will not, they won't insure product flow that's on that vessel or ship or plane or whatever it may be, you're not going to be moving anything. And so those are, again, all these are, there's so many risks to a physical asset. That's why a lot of institutions ultimately just say, listen, I'm just going to buy the ETF because, you know, I hold it in my brokerage account and I see it every day and I can hit the click button and sell it whenever I want to. But there's reasons why physical assets, have ultimate promise is that, you know, you are the legal owner of that asset. You know, you have control over it. And I think the environment that Steve mentioned that I think we're going into, you want to be able to have an asset that you have complete control and legal ownership of and held directly for, rather than leaning on an institution that may be heavily levered, especially if you're in a stock market that's going through the roof. And all of a sudden, you have some potential dislocation. You don't know what the other side's going to look like.
Yeah, and Tom, I wanted to look at this, while Bob was talking, to give you perspective what inflation can do to gold buying. Turkey, according to the World Gold Council, gold bar and coin demand was 160 tons last year, 2023. Total U.S. buying was 113. Now, Turkey is a much smaller country than the United States, and China came in at 280 tons. So when inflation starts to get out of control, you see a lot more buying, especially the Turkish lira, the inflation, the debasement of Turkish lira. So it just goes to show you, yes, last year, East was buying a lot of gold. The U.S., matter of fact, looking at the data, the U.S. Americans bought the most bar and coins since the 2008-09 financial crisis. It's been the most last year. It's dropped off considerably now. It's really nothing now, but it just goes to show you Turkey really increased, for whoever bought in Turkey, increased the bar and coin demand to up to 160 tons due to the problems with inflation. So I think when things start to change, how quickly that demand can come back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think the other part, obviously, that doesn't acknowledge moving from west to east is this, I believe it's something like 7,000 tons that China produces annually that stays within China, right? It doesn't get exported.
Yeah, most of their mine supply stays there. Mm-hmm. Correct. Now, their silver they export, but their gold, they keep most of their gold. That's correct.
And again, a big part of that, we've answered this question before. Central banks aren't looking at silver as a monetary asset or, an asset, because it's just too bulky for the amount of value that it actually stores, right?
Well, unless they wanted to bring back silver and coin, mm-hmm. It doesn't have that monetary sort of, exposure or value. Unless we went to a highly inflated scenario where all of a sudden silver would become more of you go to a bimetallic standard again. But mm-hmm. I would think you'd have to be in a pretty sad situation for that to happen. It'd be nice to see silver re-enter the monetary status, because I think it would help the industry. It would keep a lot of jobs and industry flowing, especially. And I think there's a lot of history and relevance to silver coinage and silver itself. I mean, certainly, from an industrial standpoint, it's a metal that can't be replicated, its properties, and it excels in, a numerative different things. So there's a lot of importance to it, but we're going, there's a push politically and, in the marketplace to go digital, from a convenience standpoint. But I think Steve hits it on the head. What you really got to back this thing out, to the 10,000 foot level, and the metals are a store of energy, whereas the digital world is a user of energy. And that's, I think, where he really draws an excellent paradigm and shows where the hidden value actually is.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks. And this is the interesting thing about the Bitcoin system. All the even though we invested a lot of money, a lot of capital to produce gold, some people more, let's say the green energy people say mining gold is a waste of energy. Well, maybe you could say it is, but at least the gold is there. Mm-hmm. Most of it's still there. The Bitcoin, all that energy that was consumed to produce Bitcoin is stuck in the crypto ether. There is nothing there. It isn't on the periodic table, and you can't melt it down and make a Bitcoin ring. And so when you understand that, I think the Bitcoin mining industry is very problematic in the future. It's not sustainable due to the problems with technology and energy. It just makes much more sense. We've got the gold, we've got the silver. Keep it simple, stupid. I think they will reemerge as the higher form of collateral. And so, yeah, I agree. I think it's going to take some time, but the market will figure it out. And I do see central banks acquiring silver in the future. It just makes logical sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is a push, and I think this is where the physical assets will start to gain some dominance again, and that's through tokenization. I think there is, in the digital space, there's a way to do it correctly from a ledger standpoint where you don't have to move this product from, for example, from our location in Idaho, you know, back to New York City. If you want to take a loan and JP Morgan, for example, is going to issue, you know, the loan to you, now you can tokenize and hold that asset in another location, you know, as long as it's, you know, it's you know, there's safeguards and policies and procedures in place to make sure, you know, no one could just take it. But I think tokenization does hold promise from a standpoint, not from a standpoint of trading the token on an mm-hmm. exchange, but the collateral and the financialization that can come from the usage of that token. I think that's where this next level of, I think that's where there is a big benefit in the digital world with the metals.
Yeah,
again, that tokenization isn't necessarily like a pooled style that, you know, a lot of these
right.
programs right. that have created in the last 5-10 years or 5 years or so. This is a program where you're going to have segregated assets individually tokenized that's going to be held separate apart from everybody else's token or a physical asset. So those tokens will actually tie back to a specific serial number, not necessarily to a pool of metal, if that makes sense. And that, I think that's yeah. where the value add certainly comes in. I have not seen that type of program put in place yet. You know, you know there is the advent of NFTs, and I think that's the direction to go. But I think you're still in the infancy of, I mean, because we're a depository and we can certainly do that where we can, you know, attach a private address key to a serial number bar, and all of a sudden that bar can sit on the shelf and 15 people could trade it back and forth, and that bar doesn't go anywhere, but it still ties back to a private address key. You certainly can provide that type of service, but I think, again, most depositories don't want to be bothered with the work that's involved to, mm-hmm. you know, lay out, you know, thousands of 1 ounce bars all over the place. So, yeah, but it's, I think that there is promise there.
Excellent, guys. Well, that's all we have for questions. If listeners want to submit us other questions, we can do another one of these, you know, a part two and just answer questions that come up based around all of this. I want to thank you both very much for all your time and expertise in explaining all of these very nuanced subjects. And is there anything else that you guys would like to add before we wrap up?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, a lot of these topics are somewhat complex. And I know I get even from clients, they're like, you know, we got to put on the decoder ring just to understand what the hell you're talking about, Bob. You know, so sometimes having, and I like the forums of spaces and, or, you know, like a YouTube type of, like premiere, I think is what Steve kind of calls it, where people can actually ask questions or maybe engage and interact. I like that because mm-hmm. a lot of times, you know, it's hard to explain, you know, one topic, you know, on a very two sentence type oriented answer or right. approach. You have to kind of bring it down to, you know, some sort of easier level to understand. And I think that's where, you know, sometimes I have to be stopped because I I read this stuff every day. And so to me, it's second nature. But to a lot of people, it's like, God, this is like a foreign language.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that's what I think is important about having these types of conversations, especially long form conversations, to be able to go through this. And, you know, Steve, you looking at it as well, the three of us together, I think, make those answers a bit more understandable, hopefully.
Yeah. And one thing I try to do, which is why I've been, I've gotten to know Bob and his business, is due to the integrity. And I think that's very important. You may be wrong, but you try to do the best analysis you can based on what you see, and you try to update that analysis. And that's really based on integrity, because I could go out and pump anything and do things to increase my, you know, revenues. But it may be good for me, but it's not good for the client. So when you look at something, when you look at analysis, when you look at a market, it's got to be good for everybody. And that's why I think it's very important to have a lot of integrity in the system. And so I do appreciate we sharing these details, because I think the market and investors really need to understand these details going forward.
Yeah, I think education, I think the industry could do a lot, a lot better job of educating the next go around, rather than profiteering and sort of sensationalizing, the asset or the event or situation. And I think you're going to drive more Main Street, more of a Main Street audience to this asset class. I want to see the gold and silver market prosper. Now, not that I'm just talking my book, but I think there's advantages to having an asset that's in bearer form that allows privacy, but allows flexibility. You don't see that in this world much anymore. And I think the digital realm actually potentially can constrict that type of flexibility that, you know, an individual investor may have. You know, there's more audit trail and so forth. You know, there's good things to it, and there's also, you know, there's things that maybe aren't so great. But you know, there's obviously not one asset class is the go-to. I mean, it's a gold and silver are a portion of a portfolio that mm-hmm. can be non-correlated, that can provide some degree of alpha or some degree of protection or insurance, you know, because it may perform better when other things aren't performing as good. And of course, there may be times where it doesn't perform as good as everything else going to the moon. I think, again, just trying to reestablish the metals in a better light, I think would do a lot of justice.
And Tom, one more point to conclude on. What I'm trying to write more about, and because what I do is it's a very complex world, is to try to make it where you connect, because there's so many specializations. People who are engineers really have no idea what's going on in metals. People in the economics really have no idea what's going on with energy. So I try to just make it simplified. Mm-hmm. And so the thing is, what I'm trying to get people to understand is what provides an asset its value. And so when you understand most goods and services, it's energy. And so when we understand that collateral should be based upon energy consumption, you have to start to question what is now known as collateral and how that idea of collateral is going to change. So I think, and the reason why I'm in the metals is not because I just happen to like them because they're shiny and it's kind of neat to have gold and silver. It's because they are the foundational integrity of energy in collateral. Because if you lose a gold bar back 2,000 years and you get it out of the ocean, it's the same dang thing. It hasn't rotted. But if you look at civilizations of 2,000 years, they have disintegrated. Things have disintegrated. So it's very important to understand what provides the foundation of value of assets. And when you understand that, it makes sense to really be educated why gold and silver are going to reemerge as the higher form of collateral when the world starts to head into these energy constraints. So that's basically in a nutshell what I'm trying to educate the investor. And Bob does a great job promoting and providing that service of the metals and the storage.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Sure. So, I appreciate that.
So for those that want to check out Bob's article, we'll link to it in the show notes, as well as they're all available at goldsilvervault.com. And of course, excellent Twitter follow at ProfitsPlusID. Steve, all his work is available, srsroccoreport.com, at srsroccoreport. Gentlemen, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you, Tom.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.